Hello, and welcome to The Brief, a video podcast that aims to explore vital issues and events in international affairs and bring you perspective and analysis. They're the storytellers. They document in real time events that are destined to become a dark chapter in human history. In this edition, we're going to focus on the journalists of Gaza and the West Bank, the Palestinian reporters, photographers, and media workers who have paid an unprecedented price for doing their jobs. The accounting varies, but as many as 140 journalists have been killed covering this conflict between Israel and Hamas that erupted on October the 7th, 2023. That is more journalists than were killed in the entirety of World War II. Another stunning fact, many of those Palestinian journalists were killed along with their family members. More than 600 relatives of journalists have been killed. Now, Israel has repeatedly and adamantly denied targeting journalists, challenging that with the facts. 50 journalists, 13 media organizations mounted an investigation called the Gaza Project. Two of those journalists join us for this edition of The Brief Podcast. Hoda Osman is executive editor of Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism. She's based now in New York. Waleed Batraoui, based in Toronto, is a longtime journalist and media trainer and a member of the executive board of the International Press Institute. Hello to you both, and welcome to The Brief. Hoda, I want to begin with you and ask you, before we get to the Gaza Project and the specifics of that, what's an average day like? What's the Palestinian journalist in Gaza waking up with today and as they begin to try to do their job?
I don't even know where to begin, Jim. I think that it's like nothing we've seen any journalists ever go through. I don't think this situation, we can think historically even of any other situation where journalists were trapped. They're unable to go anywhere. They're living the war themselves, and they're covering the war as well. Of course, right now, Gaza split into the north and the south. And the situation may be different for journalists in the north than it is for the south, but they all have to take care of their families in addition to doing their work. I speak to journalists there every day, and I can give you some synopsis of like some of the stories that I hear. Journalists have to make sure that their families have water, they have food. Sometimes they do this early before they start working on the reporting and on the coverage. Some of the journalists have split from their families, including for security reasons. Some of them think that being with their families is a risk to their families. So you find that many journalists are by some of the hospitals, especially the Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir el-Balah, which houses a lot of the journalists. A lot of the journalists stay there, sleep there, and maybe visit their families every few days when they can. And then the horror of reporting this, the images that we see, we see them on our devices, we see them on TV, but they see these images day in and day out themselves. Yeah. These are their colleagues. They report on their colleagues being killed. Like recently, you know, Ismail Al-Ghul, the Al Jazeera correspondent, Anas Al-Sharif, the other Al Jazeera correspondent, had to cover, he had to work as a journalist reporting on the killing of his colleague who he worked with day in and day out and whose head was completely like, you know, if I don't know if you saw this graphic image, but the strength of the strike is that the head was so disfigured, there was no head. So they have to do this every day. In addition to that, live with the fear that one day they're going to be covering maybe one of their family members or another one of their friends or another one of their colleagues. So I don't know, maybe I didn't give you an average day because there is no average day. Maybe the word average does not, you know, apply to this horrifying situation. But this is just some of what they're going through.
And Waleed, I want to ask you, in the midst of this, as the journalists are facing this, there are media organizations out there, International Press Institute, you know, the Committee for the Protection of Journalists, all of these different organizations, how are they responding to it? Things aren't normal for them either, are they?
Well, it's true. I mean, all these international organizations, the maximum they can do is to report, to document what has been going on in the Gaza Strip. Of course, you know, they have to be balanced and they have to be politically correct, as we always say, because anything that they report might be considered, you know, against the state of Israel and so on. So, I mean, they also face some restrictions in terms of reporting. I mean, and this is why we see difference in the numbers of Palestinian journalists killed in the Gaza Strip. I mean, some organizations have a certain number. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate has another number. So it's part of this is this kind of political correctness. So that's first. But then,
is there pressure applied?
I think there is. I think there is pressure applied. I think that they're trying their best to communicate with the Israeli government. But of course, I mean, the reaction would be from the Israeli government, as we have seen in the Gaza project, that they do not target journalists. And journalists are just being collateral damage of what's going on in Gaza. So, I mean, international organization, I mean, states could not do anything to protect civilians in the Gaza Strip. So the question would be, how could international organizations protect journalists? And it's very difficult. I mean, I was a trainer in Gaza, a hostile environment and safety trainer in Gaza just before the war. And I feel now ridiculous, to be honest, about everything, every single advice I gave them, because I used to tell them you have to take cover. I used to tell them you have to go to a safe place. Nothing is applicable in the Gaza Strip, and that's sadly the situation. And as Huda said, they have to move from one place to another. They have to take care of their families, especially women journalists. And when you asked about, you know, when they wake up, I don't think they sleep to wake them. So I mean, I sit on the board of the International Press Institute. I think the maximum that we did was a resolution on Gaza. We documented what is going on against journalists. I used to do a weekly Gaza dispatch, but it has been going on and on, and it's you know, it's endless. I could not, to be honest, continue emotionally. I mean, because these are my colleagues, these are people that I trained in the Gaza Strip. So just to live their experience is traumatic. So imagine being in the Gaza Strip. I mean, what can international organizations do is to pressure Israel, first of all, to stop targeting journalists. Second, to allow international journalists to go into the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of the war, only embedded journalists with the Israeli army have managed to get into Gaza, and they were all with the Israeli army. And one CNN reporter who came into Gaza under the cover of the night, and she spent like a few hours in Gaza with an Emirati medical team. So these are the only cases when journalists are where international journalists have been to Gaza. All the burden has been on the shoulder of Palestinian journalists in the Gaza Strip. So I think that there should be more pressure from international organizations. I think the issue of immunity is something that has to be dealt with. Israel has to be held to account to the crimes that it's committing against journalists.
Now, Israel, as you've noted, adamantly denies that it's specifically targeting journalists. Like you said, they're just the collateral damage. It was unavoidable. We tried to warn them. We tried to give them escape routes. And out of that denial was born the Gaza Project. And Huda, if you can tell us about it, your thinking as you and others initiated this.
Even in November, The numbers were record-breaking. The numbers of journalists who had been killed by then were already record-breaking.
That's barely a month.
That was just like, I remember in early November, it was over 30 journalists had been killed in just a month or a little over a month. So we started thinking, what we do is, our focus is investigative journalism. What can we do about this? It needs to be investigated. So we started looking at the list of the casualties and looking at each case and researching what happened. What has the Israeli military said about this particular incident? Who can we talk to? And then we started talking to other organizations, including Forbidden Stories, who takes the credit for bringing us all together and making this project a reality. When we started working together, which was in February, we basically, it was 100 journalists by then. We basically divided up the cases, looked into each one, and identified some that we can look into further to find out if we can find evidence about targeting and deliberate attacks. And as a result of this investigation, it was 50 journalists, 13 media organizations. It was published in over 16 countries, and we had a total of over 20 investigations that we worked on. I have to say that if you look at all of this together, our collective work, there is no doubt that this notion that the journalists are getting killed just because as a natural result of being in a war does not stand. Our evidence counters this idea that this is just a natural result of the war. And I can give you several quick points. One, let's just look at the numbers. Over 50% of the journalists were killed at home. So the idea that they are in combat, in crossfire, or in combat zones, and this is where they're getting killed, is already debunked. At the time, the number was close to 100. So let's stick to this number, 100. Over 80 of the 100 were killed in airstrikes. And then let's look at some other facts that we found out. There was one excellent story that was done by Forbidden Stories about drones. If you speak to anyone in Gaza, you hear the drone in the background. If you see any videos of Gaza, you will hear the drone. They call it El Zannena, which comes from an Arabic word referring to this buzzing sound that the drone makes. They're constantly, even like at night, some journalists are like, I just want to sleep. I can't even sleep because of the sound. So these drones, Mariana, who worked on this really good story, interviewed a ton of drone experts who said that drones have eyes and ears. They are constantly collecting information. They have cameras, they can hear, they can see. So how come with all this advanced technology, 18 journalists were either killed or injured by a drone? In addition to that, drones are present during these strikes and should be communicating information to, you know, should be a factor in the decision on whether or not to attack. They can see the press vest clearly. Drone experts told us that. So how come this is happening with all these, precision equipment that the Israeli military supposedly has? We also have to listen to the journalists themselves. The journalists themselves are telling us that they are being targeted. They are there. They've been there for 10 months now. And they're saying we are being targeted to the extent that just 2 days ago, one journalist told me she quit journalism. She said, my family is saying I can't do it anymore. And I agree. It's too risky. So she needs to make a living. She needs the money. But she's deciding to stop. So they're not making this up. Our investigations also found out that we had one concrete investigation with concrete evidence that media offices are being targeted. It was an investigation into an attack on the AFP offices in Gaza. And we were able to show by using visual and forensic and audio investigation techniques that whereas the Israeli military claimed that this was not an attack, a direct attack on the offices of AFP, that it actually was. And we were able to determine the area where the tanks fired against the offices. And we have a couple of other cases where this was no question. A media office, press office identified. Because mind you also, the international media especially, they communicate their location to the Israeli military. So they know that this is a media office, and yet it was fired at directly by a tank. So if you look at all of this together, you cannot say that the journalists in Gaza are just being killed as a result of the war.
Waleed, you've got the evidence. that Huda was talking about. But how about the motive? How do you prove the motive when you look at this? What are the reasons why journalists are being targeted? Why would Israel want to do that? Bad press. I mean, literally.
Well, because they have shown the whole world what's going on in Gaza. I mean, it's obvious that targeting, for example, Al Jazeera, because Al Jazeera is widely watched in the Arab countries, and some even international and Western countries are following Al Jazeera and Al Jazeera English. So that's one reason. I mean, this is what journalists in Gaza say, because we want to tell the truth to the world, and they're trying to silence us. So this is, and I think to a certain extent, yes, they have managed to silence them. Huda just said that one journalist has quit journalism, and I know others. I know others who had left with their families for their safety. I know, some journalists who just decided to go low profile and so on. Although, I mean, nothing can stop people from, taking pictures and videos and posting them on social media and so on. But the issue is that, you know, the work of journalists is different. The work of journalists is professional, is based on facts and so on. It's unlike, the social media that, could be considered, fake news or whatsoever. Even in our investigations, I think one case came and some comments came and said that this was staged. You know, someone staged the injury of a journalist, and someone staged, when an ambulance could not bring them, so they had to carry this guy with a bulldozer, to the hospital. And you know, this is all staged, and this is all staged blood. So there are people who are trying to deny the fact that this is happening. But I think the main thing is that, if you see the targeting of journalists and preventing international journalists from entering the Gaza Strip, there's only one correlation here. There's only one result, is that they don't want the truth to be out, and they say that we allow journalists as embedded, but on which side are you always, when you're embedded with the Israeli army? So you see with the eyes of the Israeli army, but you do not see with the eyes of the Palestinians. I think that's the main cause. I know that journalists have decided to just take off their vests, not to identify as journalists and continue their work as, ordinary Palestinians. And they, of course, they feel, safer. They feel that the press vest is identifying them as journalists and is making them targets. Now, the other thing that I wanted to say is about dealing with this trauma and dealing with the situation. It's very hard for journalists, to not have on your phone contacts. Hamas is governing the Gaza Strip, and it's very hard not to have contacts with Hamas, So some of the targetings were just because on your phone you have called someone from Hamas or from the government and so on. Some of the cases, we're actually targeting Al-Aqsa TV, which is, quote-unquote, considered Hamas-affiliated. And, on one hand, one Israeli, former Israeli military said, yes, they are considered as Hamas members, And then the Israeli army said, no, we're not targeting them as, quote-unquote, terrorists and so on. So This raises the question of, if you work for Al-Aqsa TV, which is run by Hamas, are you a Hamas member? This is very similar to a cleaner, for example, working for a city council, just to make a living. So, I mean, it's a very complicated issue. I mean, you cannot consider students who go to a Hamas-run school as Hamas members, and
the Israeli government, honestly, has their own television station. I mean, they have army radio, they have you know, all of these media outlets that are directly tied to the state.
I don't know if you have seen this video of an Israeli anchor with a gun.
I have not.
It's there.
Huda, it's important to note, too, that some Israelis took part in the Gaza Project.
Yes, we had 972. They were an important part of the project. And I have to say,
That's 972 Magazine.
972 Magazine. Yes,
which
I'm sorry.
The area code for Palestine, and or the country code for Palestine. But they participated as well. In what way?
They participate. They were part of the project, just like, you know, all of us. And I have to say that this was not just a gesture to create a feel-good narrative and a facade of unity between, like, the Palestinian and the Israeli journalists. We were doing substantive journalism work. 972 Magazine have done excellent work since the beginning of the war. Notably, they reported on the use of AI by the Israeli military in identifying targets. And they also reported on the ICC prosecutor being targeted and spied on by Israel. So it was great to have them as part of the project.
And as we look at this, the reaction, what has the reaction really been, Waleed, to the Gaza Project, and how, you know, there's got to be a responsibility. As you said, there's got to be accountability.
Well, the first reaction is from those who read and who believed in what we have found. And I got, like, you know, really lots of messages, lots of calls. And, you know, someone said, yeah, I knew that you would have been on the team and so on. So, I mean, it was really positive. And it was really positive, sadly. I mean, I would say it was really positive because we have, you know, we proved a theory or a hypothesis that everyone knew that is happening. So our work came to prove that hypothesis, you know. So that's the first thing. And I think that, you know, it was, you know, the widespread publication and the sharing of these investigations and, you know, translating them to Arabic. And there were some that were originally written in Arabic. And everyone was so excited about them. And we had very good feedback. But on the other side, of course, the Israeli army issued a statement saying something like a number of international media organizations, you know, mentioned so on. So we do not target journalists. And then, of course, we had these people who on Twitter said that this is, you know, as I mentioned, you know, this is fake, fake stories and fake videos and fake pictures. And of course, we have evidence of everything. We do not have to respond to every accusation because, you know, we have the evidence. We're professional journalists and we have done this to the maximum, you know, and, you know, one story was about not to run in the last minute because we did not have full evidence. Once we had that full evidence, the story ran. So, I mean, it was a very complicated and difficult investigation to all parties. And this is why...
It was very sophisticated. Huda, I want to ask you, you had audio, you had video, you had timelines, you had transmissions, cell phones, all of that.
Yeah, it was... Go ahead, Huda.
Yeah, it was a really... a collective effort. And I have to say that without us all coming together and working together on this, we wouldn't have reached these conclusions and we wouldn't have had as strong of investigations. And I want to say something else, Jim, about like kind of the effect or what happened. It is important to document and to report. As journalists, that's what we're looking for. We're not advocates. This was not done for advocacy. You know, we wanted to report and investigate what was happening. But it's important to also note that there is widespread impunity and lack of accountability. As documented by the Committee to Protect Journalists, they released a report in May of 2023 called Deadly Pattern. And they showed that over 20 years, 22 journalists have been killed. Not one. There was no one that was brought to justice. There is a pattern of Israel claiming that an investigation is going to take place. And then nothing happens. And this has been continuing with Gaza. It's overwhelming what's happening on a daily basis. So there's like, for example, the recent killing of Ismail Ghul. the Israeli military claimed that he is associated with the militants. And then the following day, there was another horrific, attack and another horrific attack. And he just like you keep moving with absolute impunity. So we're hoping that, like, you know, historically, RSF, the Reporters Without Borders, have filed 3 law cases related to 20 journalists who have been killed in Gaza. So we're hoping that it also serves what our work as a historical document that could be used in the future, maybe in such court cases.
It only matters if the international community takes action. The impunity, and I think many Israelis believe, and Hemi Shalev, one of Haaretz's former columnists, said that why shouldn't Israelis believe that they won't be held accountable for any of this, for anything that's been happening in Gaza, because they've always gotten away with it before. There is no record of accountability.
Yeah, it's just we have done it before and we'll continue doing it. So that's basically, you know, it had worked before and now, you know, we're going to continue doing it. I'll come back to this point, but let me go back to the impact. I think one most important is that journalists in Gaza, when they read these investigations, felt that they're not left alone. They're not isolated. And that someone is talking to them. And when I used to talk to their families, it was really, I mean, I thought I would face lots of difficulties of people not willing to talk about this tragedy. But there was full cooperation and they wanted to talk and they wanted to read the results that, you know, because they believe in it. They believe that this was targeted killing. And our investigations have made some kind of relief, you know. Someone has taken this, you know, and investigated this further amidst all what's going on in the Gaza Strip. So that's one part. Now, about impunity, it's just, yeah, as I said, it has been going on. I mean, in the West Bank, for example, you know, the targeting of journalists continued since a long time ago. I mean, of course, we did not have as many killed as in the Gaza Strip, but it has been going on. Huda has just mentioned that since 2000, you know, there have been a lot of over 50 journalists being killed, and no one has ever investigated. I mean, the Shireen Abu Akleh case.
This was an American-Palestinian journalist.
American-Palestinian.
Shireen worked for Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera, yes.
And shot by an Israeli sniper, which the Israeli military denied at first. They said it wasn't their fire.
Yeah, they denied it at first, and then they had to investigate it because of the U.S. pressure. And there was an independent investigation by the U.S. government. There were different investigations by local and international media organizations, including CNN and BBC. And obviously, at some point, I assume or I believe that the soldier who shot Shireen Abu Akleh is known to everyone. However, nothing has been done. No action has been taken. You know, not even the Israeli government saying that we interrogated this guy, you know, or we found out that, you know, it was by mistake. No, it's just, you know, nothing was done, although all these investigations. And this is really frustrating because, you know, on the international level, on the level of international organizations, if such obvious cases have escaped punishment, you know, what can else be done in order to hold the Israeli government to account for the crimes?
Handle that question. What else can you do? Is this project still ongoing in some ways?
It is. We plan, at least from Arija's side, and we've been speaking to others who were partners as well, we plan to keep on going. Since we published our investigation on June 25th, quite a large number of journalists have been killed since. So we already had some cases that we wanted to investigate further of the original list. So I don't think we can stop until this stops somehow. And I feel even then, there's going to be so much. There's so much material, Jim. There's so much to be looked into. We have so much material of like cases and stories that we haven't even had time to look into. So we're definitely going to keep going.
That would be, I would think, encouraging to the journalists in Gaza. But more than anything else, what those journalists need today is probably a ceasefire. And we all know that that is looking, it's just difficult. It's a, you know, there's a lot of people that don't think it's going to happen so long as Prime Minister Netanyahu remains in the seat of power there. But as you move forward, what gives you hope? What gives you, think, the journalists hope in Gaza? Waleed, you can take that.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, the only thing they want now is a ceasefire. But as we move, I think, as I said, there's little hope of what's, you know, of escaping this war, you know. But at least we're documenting. They feel that we are with them. They feel that someone is watching what's going on. And at some point, you know, the hope is that someone is going to be held to account, although there's no inner belief in that. But this is a hope that everyone wants, you know, that everyone keeps and themselves and so on. So I think that I've seen, you know, the good thing. Let me just look at the positive thing, you know. The good thing is that they haven't stopped. They continue to work. They know that their life is at risk. Press House, one of the media houses that was totally demolished and that hosted lots of journalists and trained them and so on, now is working from a tent. They got some funding from international organizations, and they resumed working. I have seen them advertising for jobs and so on. So this is the hope. This is the hope that we're trying to give to Palestinian journalists in the Gaza Strip and also in the West Bank, because our work also focused on the West Bank, on targeting journalists in the West Bank, although luckily no one was killed in these cases that we have documented. But at least they feel that there's something going on, someone is watching, and one day someone will hold someone to account.
Can I say something about this, Jim, as well? I don't know if I can. I completely agree with Waleed on this idea of continuation and sort of resilience that I have to say I've never in my life seen such, you know, a drive to just continue to keep on doing what they're doing. I was going to mention Press House. This Press House story is incredible. The fact that they are now like starting to operate, even if it's in a minimal capacity again. There's also a female journalist who was injured a few days ago in that same on that same day, she was injured and another journalist was killed. Yesterday, I found out that she's already produced her first report just a couple of days after the journalist was injured. As she's recovering, she's already starting to work again.
It is vital for some of these people to be able to work. That's how they earn their, that's how they feed their families. And it's a very tough decision when someone has to step away. How much pressure is being placed on the journalists by the Israeli government? Are there direct threats for journalists to stand down?
Well, I think, yes. I mean, the killing by itself, the targeted killing by itself is a threat. But also, I mean, you know, now in the Gaza Strip, as you know, the Israeli army is on the ground and they control everything. I'm not sure if they are in direct contact with journalists in the Gaza Strip, but if we look at the West Bank, yes, there is a continuous threat to journalists, not only by the Israeli army, but also by Israeli settlers who hate to see journalists working, you know, and it's as in Gaza, journalists are getting rid of the flag jackets. Journalists in the West Bank are getting rid of the press signs. And you know, Jim, you have been in the West Bank, and once you're a journalist, you have to put a press sign and so on. So you prefer to travel as a regular Palestinian. That doesn't mean that there's less risk, you know, if you're an ordinary Palestinian, but there's direct targeting if you are a journalist. And this has been not only, you know, in the few recent years, but also, I mean, there are all sorts of restrictions on Palestinian journalists, starting from movement restriction. You know, a Palestinian journalist from Ramallah cannot work in East Jerusalem, which is considered the West Bank. Palestinian journalists, you know, before the war in Gaza could not go down to the Gaza Strip, which is part of the Palestinian territory. It's very hard to travel from one place to another within the West Bank because of checkpoints and so on, even if you are a journalist. And the only press card that they recognize is the Israeli government press card, you know, Israeli government press office press card that is that was taken from Palestinian journalists in March 2000.
We haven't, Huda, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about the West Bank and what is going on there. There's a new security chief in Israel, and it's not making people very optimistic about the future and how things will be handled, specifically because the settlers, the most extreme groups of settlers, seem to have gained the upper hand there. And their intentions in regard to Palestinians and journalists as well, pretty specific and pretty clear.
I think the videos recently of the settlers and the settler attacks have been just very alarming and very extremely horrifying. It's unclear how to put this under control. It seems to have gotten out of control. The journalists in the West Bank, as Walid was explaining, are also like under attack constantly. And the worry is, this is also overwhelming. Everything that's happening in Gaza, you know, the West Bank, sometimes you feel like you're worried that it's going to be forgotten because of how the scale of, you know, the whatever is happening in Gaza. So extremely worrisome, extremely concerning. And yeah.
Well, some people look at the government in Israel today as the most extreme right-wing government in the country's history. And they just worry that things are being taken too far. And you're right, we don't look at the West Bank just because the violence is so horrific in Gaza. We tend to forget or skip over what is happening on the West Bank. But their violence against Palestinians, you know, by settlers and others, you know, has gone unanswered by the military that's supposed to protect them.
Yeah.
As an occupying
power.
Yeah,
I feel that even, like, let's talk a bit about the response. I feel like that the Israeli army and government don't feel even a need to respond anymore. With regards to the journalists, there have been letters and, you know, statements and calls. And even as part of our project, the Gaza project, of course, we had to, you know, present the Israeli military with our cases and our evidence and ask them for a response. And even though they did give us a response and a lengthy response, it was really, you know, meaningless, mostly. There was no serious response to the questions that we had or the evidence that we had. And this applies to everything else. West Bank, Gaza, it seems that they don't feel even a need anymore to respond to any of these, on any of the pressure that is being put on them.
Jim, let me just note one thing. It's not only against Palestinian journalists, you know, to be frank. I mean, we have seen that the Foreign Press Association in Israel has issued lots of statements recently. One of them was about the Jerusalem incident back in May. It's during the March of Flags, you know, when Israeli settlers went to and when they came to Damascus Gate and so on, and they were harassed by the Israelis themselves, the Israeli civilians themselves, as well as the police. And there was a statement that has been put forward to the police and complained to the police about that. And the response was really as usual. Now, also banning Al Jazeera, for example, from working inside Israel is something that has never happened, you know, before. And you know, Al Jazeera English has to report from Gaza, and Al Jazeera Arabic from the West Bank. Now, there are also many media offices that are within the jurisdiction of the Palestinian Authority has been closed by the Israeli army because they are service providers for certain, you know, quote-unquote, enemy media organizations like Al Manar, for example, or Press TV, the Iranian, and so on. They were just service providers, you know, and they were closed. So it's continuous. It does not stop. And it's really unsafe to be on the West Bank or East Jerusalem.
Palestinian journalists aren't just being killed and wounded. Their family members killed and wounded. They're also being smeared in the process. They're being accused of being terrorists. They're being accused of, you know, supporting foreign governments and foreign powers. It's almost unspeakable the way that they're being abused, the way their very memory is being abused.
Yes, and they feel it. They feel that they're being discredited. I have to say, as part of the Gaza Project, our investigation was about journalists. So as a result of that, many of our sources were journalists themselves. So we interviewed a lot of journalists. And I've seen a very high level of professionalism and accuracy. Whatever I asked for, they verified it. They provided me with like the pictures with a timestamp. If they didn't remember something, they would tell me, I don't know it or I don't remember it. So very professional working with these journalists. So it's really a pity to see them being discredited and treated this way.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with Huda. I mean, they wanted, you know, they know that they're under the spot and they wanted to provide accurate evidence. And it's the same case. When I spoke to people, they would say, you know, I don't remember. Let me go back to the videos. Let me check the date. Let me check the location and so on. Now, with the Israeli propaganda at the beginning of the war, when they started shaming Palestinians, shaming and naming journalists, you know, of taking part in the October 7th attacks and so on. I asked one journalist actually about that because he was one of the, he was targeted by a drone and he lost his leg and now he's in Qatar and he was accused. So I asked him this question. He said, well, I'm a journalist, you know, if I hear something nearby, I jumped immediately to see what was going on. And this is kind of, you know, an exclusive scoop for me. So I started filming. You know, I wasn't part of that. Yes, I did go inside Israel. I filmed that. Yes, but I did not know about it. But it happened. Everyone, you know, every professional. I mean, if you hear something next to your door, you know, you would jump immediately as a journalist to cover it. And this is exactly what happened. Now, unfortunately, at the beginning of the war, when some names have been mentioned and they worked for international media, unfortunately, the international media's reaction was to immediately fire them without further investigation. And that's really sad. And that takes us again to the issue of political correctness. We want to be politically correct with the Israelis. We want to continue our work. We don't want to challenge them. This is a war. We're not part of it. Yes, we're not part of it. But at least, you know, for those people who have been reporting for you accurately over the past 15 years, it takes you 1 minute to fire them because the Israelis said that they knew about what was going on, you know? I think if I were an editor someone, you know, in a high position in one of these organizations, I would say that it was their duty to go and cover that. If they hadn't, you know, I would fire them if they hadn't gone to do that, you know, provided that they're safe. So I think that, you know, it's just unbelievable how easy to start accusing people, saying that, you know, for example, the son of Wael Dahdouh, who's the bureau chief of Al Jazeera, works for the Islamic Jihad for $400. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Someone who gets thousands of dollars, you know, to work for $400. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And they put that as an evidence. And of course, you know, they put it once. Then they with Ismail Ghul, they also accuse him of being a terrorist. I mean, it's just easy. You know, I'm sitting here, I could be accused now of being anti-Semite, for example, because of talking about the truth. The other thing is that, you know, harassment goes beyond the physical harassment. There's the online harassment that Palestinian journalists are facing, you know, the censorship on the Palestinian content. If you say Hamas, while in the West Bank, the IP address is the West Bank. You know, you cannot. It would be banned immediately. But if you're in Tel Aviv and you write Hamas, it wouldn't be banned. You know, because of the IP address. So it's really so complicated. It's not only the physical and personal issue, but also it's the online harassment and the psychological pressure put on Palestinian journalists.
To bring us full circle, Huda, what do you think? What's going to be the legacy of these journalists, that not only the ones who have sacrificed their lives, but the ones who have endured this for so long? What is their legacy?
I was telling one of the journalists recently, they just amaze me, you know, by doing what they do.
I think they amaze all of us.
And I was telling her, if you get awarded all the awards for the next 20 years, it's not going to be enough. I don't think there's anything we can do. There's any way to appreciate or really absorb, understand what they've done and what they continue to do. It is beyond words.
Waleed, your final words?
Well, I think the legacy is documenting history, documenting what has been going on. Without these Palestinian journalists being in the Gaza Strip, no one would have known what's going on. All that movement around the world would have not really known what's going on. I think it's very hard to talk on behalf of the Palestinian journalists in Gaza, but I think that the legacy is that, you know, for those who were killed, they will still be remembered. Everyone will be talking about them. Prizes and whatever and awards and so on are not very important for them, but they have lost everything. They have lost their lives, and the remaining members of the families have lost their houses, equipment, media houses have been demolished and so on. So I think the legacy is that they're still alive, and that they're still working and documenting what's going on.
Doing the job that they love. And I thank you both for doing a job I know that you love. Waleed Petraoui, Huda Osman, I want to thank you both for being with us on The Brief.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having us.
And thank you for joining us. Please explore many of our other episodes of The Brief podcast here on YouTube, on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you like to tune in. Give us a like or subscribe. For now, I'm your host, Jim Clancy, and you've been briefed.